Welcome to the Property Couch, where each week you get to listen to two of Australia's leading property experts as they share with you the insider's guide to property investing.
Hello folks, you're on the Property Couch, your insider's guide to property investing. I'm Bryce Holdaway, he's Ben Kingsley, and today we're going to be taking our listener questions, Ben.
We are, Bryce, yes. Q&A session. I'm looking forward to it. I haven't seen the questions yet, so throw them out there.
We might have had a very brief look at them, so we like to do things on the fly so we can keep it as organic as possible. But we've got a question here from Dan. Question is buying a home and living in an investment property. We've got an investment property in Canberra, but would like to buy a PPR in Melbourne, principal place of residence. Without selling the investment property, we can't afford a three-bedroom house, in brackets, one kid and one on the way. So without going as far out as, say, Mentone, because our budget is $600,000. Question, should we buy another investment property in a high-growth location and keep renting, or move a bit further out and getting something we can afford? Loving the podcast so far. Thanks, Dan. All right, well, Ben, there's actually quite a few layers there, and it's kind of along the lines of rent and grow rich. And if you think about the fact that my father is born in 1939. My mother's born in 1948. I'm born in 1975. My wife's 1980. There's four generations across the dinner table. And if you actually suggested this to my father, who was born in 1939, he'd say you're mad.
Mad, stupid, dumb. What are you doing, son? Bloody hell.
But if you're talking to a Gen Y, they need this stuff up. Rent and grow rich is all the rage.
Yeah, look, it's the new rage at the moment, because people are choosing a lifestyle to live in an area that they want to live, but realizing that they can still use that surplus money to invest in property. So it's certainly a growing trend that we're currently seeing. And coming back to your question, Dan, it's really important to understand that to give advice over a podcast or any type of things, we need to understand your full financial circumstances. So assuming that we don't understand those, and obviously, we would say go and get some advice in more detail. The first thing I'd always say to people when they raise the question, we can't afford, I would determine that as a property investment advisor. So I'd do detailed analysis of your current cash flows. I'd look at the equity available in the current property, and then I'd make a determination around what you could afford in your budget. Now, it's good to see that you've done, I don't know what sort of levels of depth you've gone to, but in the budgets and the analysis work that I do, I look at cash flow management by month for the next 40 years. I try and track every cent. And so that will allow me to understand whether it is wise to be able to afford that. Now, coming in to say, buying a three-bedroom house, that's true. And this comes back to this whole fictitious belief that potentially the value is in the land, Bryce, when we know that maybe that $600,000 property could get us a townhouse a little bit closer in, maybe Preston, maybe somewhere around Brunswick, maybe somewhere like, in the inner west. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it's like, well, that's going to do me, because ultimately I've still got my backyard where the kids can have their swinging playground, but I've got the three bedrooms, one bathroom, all that I need. And then ultimately down the track, that's a stepping stone. Mm. So one, we haven't had to sell Canberra, which is brilliant, because what's interesting about the Canberra market is the actual take up of rental accommodation at the moment's really starting to show its wares, because the market is past its prime, and it's in a recovery state. So we're now starting to see rents improve and vacancy rates decrease as part of the natural cycle. And then we're coming into the Melbourne market and we're sort of saying, okay, well, what can I buy? So don't think you're trapped into going out wide. You can come inside.
And I tend to agree with Ben. You've got to really look under the bonnet to find your circumstances. But on a bigger picture level, Dan, I don't think that it is a bad idea to consider the idea of renting in a lifestyle location, because effectively, if you find a place that you're comfortable in living in that really offers all the lifestyle that you want, effectively you've got the landlord worrying about the rates and the bills and the maintenance and all those sorts of things, and you can just get on with building your portfolio and achieving your financial goals. So the point is this, that rewind maybe 20 years ago, they'd see this as a crazy idea, but given that we think, Ben and I chat about this all the time, given that there's no organic injection left in injection of household cash flow anymore, given that we're now double income families, we're now double income professional families, we're now at historically low interest rates, effectively we see that there'll be two tiers of property market, where the suburbs that are investment grade, which have demographics where the income is likely to support increasing prices, and then you'll have another tier where you'll get glass ceilings in terms of those prices. It just makes sense that if the rising tide isn't going to lift all ships anymore, that you need to make the best decisions that you possibly can to, I guess, achieve your financial goals. And it might just mean that you're renting for a short period of time, build the wealth base, and then leverage that to get your new principal place of residence where you want to be.
It's just going to come down to your personal circumstances, guys. You're going to have an internal discussion with yourselves about your 5-10 year plan, and then work through that and sort of say, how important is wealth creation over owning something that we can put our own picture frames up with? That's the type of conversation you need to have yourself, because we do know, it's fact, that if you do rent and then you take the surplus between the rent as to what you were paying on a mortgage and you reinvest that into other properties, you will retire wealthier. That model is in. You know, the numbers work. So it's just really going to come down to your personal circumstances and how determined you are to either create wealth or have that work-life balance.
Yeah, it's a good question, Dan. So the bigger picture is you should definitely, get more specific advice about your circumstances, and B, definitely consider the rent and grow rich model if it works for you in your circumstances. So thanks again. Okay, Leah Donaldson. She sent us an email here, Ben, or gone onto the website and left some details. And there's actually four parts here. So there's some really rich questions. So, hi guys, love the YouTube channel. I've listened to the first 6 episodes in the last 2 days. I have a few questions. I know you might not be able to answer all of them in the podcast, but here goes. Number one, a recent media story in Adelaide suggested that negative gearing through investment properties is a form of tax evasion and costs the economy over $5 billion in lost tax revenue per year. They went on to say that Joe Hockey highlighted this as a possible area to draw funds from in the future. My question is this. In your opinion, do you think the tax rules around negative gearing will change in the future so as to not benefit those investing in multiple properties? Over to you, Ben.
Okay, so let's understand something quite fundamental about being in the business of investing. So let's try and eradicate the idea it's property, because it's an easy target and people understand it, so it makes sense to be a political target. But the reality is we're going into the business of running an investment. And in this business, for negative gearing, what we've done is we've borrowed money. Okay, so we've got income coming in from the property in terms of the rent, and we've got outgoings. Now, at the start of our business, we might have a shortfall, meaning that doesn't cover our repayments on our debt and also any upkeep and maintenance on the property. So all of a sudden, we've got this shortfall. Now, this shortfall does allow us to do what we call a book loss, and that book loss will then allow you to deduct that against your income and any tax that you have paid. Now, it's crazy to think that people would go into investing in property to run a business at a loss. Mm. It's just stupid. So the reality is that over time, those negatively geared properties do become positively geared, and you start paying tax on those particular investments. In other words, we've gone into business. It's taken us a while to get into groove, and we're now into the groove. We're paying the debt down, and all of a sudden, it's now positively geared. And if I'm going to invest in property for the long term, I'm investing for a passive income. So I do expect on the $160,000 passive income that is my personal target that I'm going to have to pay tax on that. And I've factored those into my models. So there's a big point and a big message here. Do I think it's going to change? No, I don't think it is, because, you know, I suspect under this current phase of property buying and investment buying at the moment, we've probably got over 2 million property investors out there now. So that's 2 million voters. And those 2 million voters want a surety around how they're investing their money. And whether it be they can negatively gear art, they can negatively gear shares. So it shouldn't just be on property. So it's not tax avoidance per se. It's not illegal. Basically, what's happening is we're going into the business of investing, and in the earlier stages, it's costing us money. So we're getting that. Now, the government does have their day in the sun. They recoup money through investing through stamp duties, through through state governments. They also get council rates to run the amenity around the local area, paid by the investor. And finally, the federal government, if the property is sold, gets a capital gains event. So all it is basically forward booking a loss, but down the track, the government does get their revenues and they get it across the board. So my worry with negative gearing, if it does become a political football and a soft target, is that governments are going to make silly decisions based on not having all the facts. And all those facts we need to say, and I put this out to the ATO, if you're listening, someone from the ATO or ASIC, come back and tell me how much tax is paid on people who have positively geared portfolios. I started my portfolio when I was 23. My portfolio, or my wife's portfolio and my portfolio, is positively geared. So we're paying tax. And so why doesn't the ATO come out and say, okay, well, there might be $5 billion in lost tax revenues, but interestingly enough, there was receipts of $12 or $15 billion in rental income, which we claim tax at, you know, we were able to receive tax from. And what about also stating how much people make at a capital gains events? How much does that go into the coffers of government as well? So if we're going to have this debate, we've got to have it on every level.
Yeah, Leo, I think the focus of the headline is always about the lost revenue rather than the revenue that's coming in the back door because of it. So if you think about the budget that was handed down a couple of weeks ago, and they gave a small business concession for $20,000, you can immediately expense it in the first year, and they were predicting that that would cost them about $5.5 billion. They actually couldn't work out exactly how much, but their estimates were $5.5 billion. So if you focus on the fact that they're spending $5.5 billion, you probably think, well, what's the agenda? But their agenda is to bring in more than $5.5 billion in increased profits to the small business sector. They can employ more people who will pay more income tax. So the multiplier effect of that decision means that they get more revenue in the back door. So ultimately, that is why, in my view, they've actually tried to remove negative gearing back in 1983. It was a disaster. They brought it back in 1985 because it would be up to the federal government not only to provide housing where the private sector provides it, but they'd also have lots of lost revenue as well.
And Bryce, the counter argument to this conversation is people saying it pushes the value of prices higher. I cannot disagree more. I mean, this stimulus or this incentive, because at the end of the day, if you're investing in property to run a loss, you're an idiot. But this incentive does help people and developers build stock. So when they build, you know, 20 units or 30 units, they expect that 50%, if not 70% of those will be sold to owner-occupiers and 30% to 50% will be sold to investors. That's investor stock. Now, when they're building these things, if they don't have that 20 or 30% pre-sale, they don't get off the ground. So if you really want a way of reducing the amount of supply in the market, take away negative gearing and see how much that will disrupt supply. I mean, the biggest challenge we've got now, this story is a supply story, this current run, and obviously cheap and affordable money. But you take that, you increase that supply, then ultimately you're going to see a better outcome from an affordability point of view.
Agreed. Very good. So part four of the question, so we'll just jump forward there, Leah, is how do you diversify your property portfolio? I understand it's wise to invest in different capital cities so you can catch growth in different areas at different times. Anything else we can do? Well, I think that's an important point that you raise, to be a borderless investor, because quite often I see people are quite unwilling to invest outside their own backyard. So the first part of your question is very good, and it sounds like you're comfortable with that, but the point here is not everyone is comfortable with being a borderless investor, but ultimately after you've bought your first one, where there's a very steep learning curve, it's very wise to invest in different capital cities. But I guess ultimately you're going to, if you do build a portfolio of property and you have multiple properties in any one state, you will start to hit land tax thresholds. Mm-hmm. And whilst we can't give you any advice, I would say that you could approach your accountant and talk about what names you would purchase the properties in to help you get around sort of land tax in terms of you diversifying.
Look, and if you're paying your fair share of tax, it means you're successful. I mean, I pay land tax in Victoria, New South Wales, not in Queensland yet, but I've got property in every one of those states. So the reality, guys, is when you're looking to invest in property, not only just the city, but it also determines some of the suburbs you invest in. I remember when we bought the property in Alexandria in Sydney in 2001, we did bid on an Art Deco apartment in Randwick, and that Art Deco apartment went for $415,000 on the hammer. We were the underbidders, and then we secured a two-bedroom semi in Alexandria. Once we started doing more research, we felt that that was a better long-term prospect. And we paid $395,000 for that in 2001. And in the current market, oh my God, I could probably get $1.1 million for it. Whereas that apartment in Randwick might be a $750,000 apartment. So it just goes to show you that location selection also within a city is absolutely paramount. And also then finally, the property on top of that is going to deliver you your returns as well.
So Ben, we always talk about getting the investment grade location sorted first and then the investment grade property sorted second. So we've got a question here from Mark Jackson about finding an investment property. Hi guys, thanks for the great info covered so far. It's been great. I'm currently looking for an investment property in Brisbane within 10 kilometres of the CBD as a unit or a townhouse. How do you identify high disposable income suburbs? And if buying in a block of units, how do you work out if there are more owner-occupiers than renters in that building and area? What do you think of the dual living homes being built at the moment in Queensland, where there is a granny flat component attached to the house, so you receive two rents? Look forward to the response. So there's two parts to the question, Ben.
There is. So the fundamentals, you've got that right there in terms of what you're looking to do. Mark. So Mark, what's happening here is... where you find the income story, you find it through the census data. Okay, so census data is the wealth of information around income, and that's what you want to be studying. So you want to be studying, most importantly, income and then the age correlation. So I'd be looking for the majority of the people in the area, and I'd be backdating your income overlay. So you'd be going 91, 96, 2001, 2006, 2011 census data and looking at the increase in disposable incomes in the household. Then you'd be overlaying that with the age bracket, and the sweet spot is people in their sort of mid-30s. So the majority of your population in the mid-30s. So that's always a good indicator in terms of identifying those locations. Then once you've identified those locations, you're looking for the lifestyle drivers. So the amenity, the convenience, the transport nodes, all those things that then overlay to sort of finish off your location research. Once you've done that, you then start to getting into looking at the actual blocks. Now, if I'm in a small block in a city, and even if it's got 90% investor, when I mean, you know, there could be 14 apartments in the block in Brisbane, if 90% of those are still investors, that doesn't trouble me so much because I'm looking at the tenants that are in there, you know, carrying their Apple laptops out the door or they're on their smartphones, and I'm seeing how they're dressed and I'm seeing the cars pulling into the driveway. And those types of things, I'm not too worried about that. If I was investing in a mass development, you bet I'm worried about that, because in an economic downturn or if there's lots of mum and dad investors who are all going to turn 65 at the same time, you could get a flood of people selling out and cashing in those properties. And from our point of view, that's a danger. So we'll always focus on small blocks, won't we, Bryce?
Yeah, absolutely. Because we always say that, and I'm borrowing your term here, Ben, that if you're as an investor, you want to be a price taker, not a price maker. And so if you're in a suburb that is investment grade, that's highly dominated by owner-occupiers and beautiful period homes or whatever, and then you're in a small block of units, effectively you're just getting sucked along for the ride. Mm. So it doesn't matter if there's a high percentage of investors in a small boutique block for that reason. And I guess for the first part, I agree with Ben, for us to identify an investment grade suburb, we're looking for trends in income over the period of time. So as Ben talked about those census periods, I do this specifically when I'm dealing with a client, when we identify a suburb. I want to see trends where maybe the income in the suburb, say back in 96, was below the average for the city that I'm in. And then over time, it starts to grow where the income for the suburb is actually greater than the average. And you can see a real trend where it's starting to grow, because they're your real lead indicators. Now, in terms of how do you work out if there are more owner occupiers in the building, we subscribe to a number of databases. The most popular one for us is CoreLogic RP Data. That's a significant investment by us to get access to that data. So I can actually see if there's a block of six, I can actually marry up the address of the property with the address of the owner to see if it's an absentee owner or not, to identify the owner occupier. But I must admit, to the general investor, that information is quite difficult to get your hands on. And I guess it's one of the value adds that you would get from going and speaking to a professional who has access to that sort of data.
I mean, to give our listeners an idea, we spend about $100,000, in excess of $100,000 a year in our research department. So that's on either obtaining data, analysing that data, our full-time research assistants. That's the sort of level that we go to, because at the end of the day, our clients are paying us money and they're expecting a return. If the general consumer just can't compete with the 10 million data points that we're looking at to basically, you know, give us our trigger location. So that's not to say you can't find this. I mean, you know, you do the grunt work, just like I did back in when I was 23, and you walk the streets and you analyze it every weekend and you spend 6 months in a particular marketplace and you know it backwards. That's great, but you've got to ask yourself the question, what's in the other city? You know, and is that still going to be the suburb on the area that's going to give me the outperform result?
Now, the last part of that question is about dual living, Ben, granny flats. So my view on that, because we're getting close to 20 minutes here, and I'll get your thoughts as well, is effectively it's great to get a second income component because it can actually help you fund the debt and fund the portfolio. So depending on what you need within your portfolio, if you need growth,
that's right.
I wouldn't target these if it was to the detriment of the owner-occupier appeal, if it didn't have the detriment to that, or you're at the latter part of your portfolio and you need some cash cows to help you retire the debt, that could be a good solution. But as we always say in these types of questions, it's very, very difficult to give you a generalised answer to a specific question because we don't know your circumstances.
And a sales agent's going to do a very compelling job in convincing you that this property, by the time you buy it, it's going to give you $50 a week. So you're thinking, well, why don't I just replicate this out hundreds of times and I'm sweet. But the reality is it's going to give you that additional income because you're compromising the asset for other appeals. So if you're going to chase that yield story, you're going to compromise the potential long-term capital growth on that particular property, which is not the end of the world. And again, it comes down to case by case, and that's why no two investment strategies that we build, Bryce, are exactly the same, are they?
They're not. But folks, I think rent is what keeps you in the market and capital growth is what you get out of the market.
Oh, wait a minute. Say that again, Bryce. That was gold.
So rent is essentially what keeps you in the market and, of course, the capital growth is what you get out of the market because the rent is actually a product of the capital growth.
I'm writing that down.
We'll put that on the website. So, folks, 20 minutes has come and gone in a blink. So thank you to Mark. Thank you to Ryan. Thank you to Leah. We've actually got a few other questions that we can cover in a future podcast as well. And I'd certainly encourage you to go to thepropertycouch.com.au so that you can leave us your feedback and let us know what questions you want answered in an upcoming episode of the podcast. And, of course, if you go to our social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, you can follow us there to know when the episodes have come out. There you go, folks. That is this week's episode of The Property Couch. We look forward to catching up with you next week. And until next week, Ben.
Arrivederci.
See you, folks.